If you like what you're hearing on the Security Ledger podcast, consider subscribing to one of our newsletters like the Daily Ledger or the Weekly Ledger. You can learn more and sign up at securityledger.com/subscribe. Hello and welcome to the Security Ledger podcast. I'm Paul Roberts, editor-in-chief at the Security Ledger. In this week's episode of the podcast, number 109, industrial control system hacking isn't just for nation states anymore. We'll speak with a researcher at the firm Cyber Reason about their evidence that cyber criminals are getting into the critical infrastructure hacking game too. But first, in the wake of the 2016 presidential election, studying social media activity has gone from a niche obsession for a few social scientists to something like a national security priority. Accordingly, new analysis of the activity of Twitterbot and networks of fake social media profiles now pop up on a regular basis and just as frequently garner mainstream media attention. But what is hiding out there among the many competing online influence campaigns? And just as important, is our understanding of how these campaigns work accurate? To try to answer that, we invited Dave Itell back into the Security Ledger Studio. Formerly the founder and CTO of the firm Immunity, Dave is now the Chief Technical Security Officer of the Threat Management and Analytics Division of the firm Cyxtera, which acquired Immunity. He recently completed an analysis of the Twitter bot data linked to the Russian Internet Research Agency using a powerful machine learning tool. Itell was shocked by what he discovered, including the prevalence of Russian efforts to organize real-world gatherings of individuals in the U.S. by targeting military and survivalist communities. Those included invitations to join a group going by the name of the U.S. Freedom Army. But Itell was also skeptical of many of the conclusions reached by analysis of recent Twitter data dumps, and individuals who try to sort out or categorize amorphous data sets of tweets and social media posts risk engaging in what he describes as autoethnography. I started out by asking Dave to talk about the difficulty of analyzing the output of social media networks like Twitter at scale.
One of the things that I took away from your post is that doing data analysis or trend analysis or whatever on huge data dumps of tweets is like not for the faint of heart, and that in the process of analyzing it, you really have to be careful that you're not kind of selectively analyzing it or just simply writing your own bias onto this huge amorphous set of data.
Yeah.
And how do you even know if it's the right data?
Which of course you
are. Right, right.
Right, like that's the thing about it, which of course you are. And then what people do, every person does this, because the easiest thing to do is a histogram. And they count how many tweets happen on what day, and then they say, hey, more tweets happened on like October 3rd than October 4th. And on October 4th, the following random real-world event happened. And they're like, so they must be connected.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's just not how causation and correlation work. And these are PhDs. You know what I'm saying? Like, you have a science degree in theory. I'm like, what were they thinking? So and it's all over their paper. Their paper is like all of that. That's it. That's what they've got. I'm like, you know who did a better job was the Duo security team. But there's some interesting stuff in the Duo security paper. For some reason, they don't want to say, I assume Twitter's a customer, because they did analysis that tells them exactly what percentage of Twitter's actual users are bots. But they refuse to say what that percentage is, which I find fascinating.
Yeah, well, it's like, right, like if you know, why are you not saying? Because that's actually a really interesting data point that I think we'd all be interested in.
Someone tell me why they're not telling.
Right, because it's probably like 30% of Twitter's user base.
Right, but then isn't that amazing?
Not for Twitter's like, shareholders,
and here's
but yes.
The other thing. Do you ever buy Twitter ads?
I'm trying to think if I ever, I may have to promote an event. Yeah, yes, I think I have.
Did you ever go and look
tweets?
At the interactions on those tweets? You ever look at the users?
Yes.
Did you notice how many were bots?
Well, yeah. I mean, that was sort of my recollection doing sponsored tweets to promote an event and just sort of like, well, that was a waste of money because, yeah, it's like none
right.
of these people...
Like half of them are bots.
Half of them are bots, right.
But think about it. Like, why doesn't Twitter want to get rid of the bots? It's because every time one of those bots clicks on your freaking sponsored tweet, they get a dollar. So to me, it's sort of fascinating. Like, there's a reason Twitter hasn't, like, shut down the bots. Because it's not like they can't. Why not shut down the bus? Because they're getting paid not to, right? Like, where's their money coming from? So all those things I find fascinating. Like, in order to actually get rid of IO, this is my conclusion, we have to find a way to penalize Twitter for having bots financially. Because right now they're incentivized to encourage bots.
That's right.
If we declare a bot, we have to make Twitter give back all that money.
It would be like if the Boston Globe or the New York Times were, you know, sending hundreds of thousands of papers to sort of like a warehouse in, you know, New Jersey, where they were just collected and recycled back into paper or something, you know, and say, well, we've got, you know, 3 million subscribers.
That's exactly what it is. It's fraud.
Right. As you well know, I mean, this is in display advertising as well. And you know, you know, there's some scary figures about how much of website traffic is automated in some way. Either it's Google's crawlers or it's, you know, kind of bogus pay-per-click stuff. And that's sort of undergirding the online ad ecosystem, which is propping up the publishing industry or a good part of it.
And then, like, the bleed into politics is fascinating. I mean, I don't know if, like, some of the stuff you saw on that blog post was a surprise to you, but it was a surprise to me that they tried to start their own American army.
Yeah, the U.S. Freedom Army.
Yeah.
That was really fascinating. Talk about that. How did that emerge from the data you were looking at, and what do we know? I don't know if anyone had picked up on that before.
I certainly have not heard of it. Now, I went and looked at, like, right-wing survivalist websites, and they'd noticed it because it's getting pushed at them. They're like, oh, it seems a little fishy. But I'm like, yeah, because it's the Russians. like,
what's fishy about the person trying to start an independent army within the United States? There's nothing
like,
so what the fishing about
is
that.
My, like, why is that still there? That's straight up. I don't know what the insurgency tactics. I don't know what
we got a fifth column type stuff. Yeah.
I assume the feds have hacked that website or they would not have left it up. Like, surely I'm not the only one who can search tweets, but I don't know.
Right.
I honestly don't know if we knew, because our cyber policy, like, engine, as you know, has a few spanners in the works. So I honestly could not tell you right now if it was in fact being handled properly. In other times, I'd have more confidence.
I know Ben Schreckinger at Politico did a really interesting story where he looked at all the work that I guess the Russians were doing with, like, this. He had one website in particular that was being used, that was like a job site for veterans, and it was being used to channel a whole lot of really nasty stuff at vets.
I think people have a very one-dimensional view of this behavior in a lot of ways. Like, for example, the internet, the tweet bots that we're seeing are often reused. Like, they start out as porn bots, and then they end up as, like, SoundCloud bots, and then they go on and push propaganda. So,
and then they're back to promoting SoundCloud.
And then they're back to SoundCloud. Yeah, so it's sort of like, it's a business. It's doing different things. And this happens to be one of the customers. But if you're in Russia, and the government comes to you and looks at what you've got, what's your other option? You see what I'm saying? Like, I don't know if indictments are the right answer here, because they didn't have another option.
I mean, one question I would have is, and, you know, we should disclose here, you worked as an analyst, as an intelligence analyst yourself. On the one hand, all this data is really, really useful. It's there. You can analyze it. On the other hand, as you pointed out, analyzing it is not as straightforward as you might think, and it's easy to get it wrong. You don't want to be drawing the wrong inferences from the data, but, of course, the data set is so huge and mushy. How can you even know when you've got all the data? As you said in your blog post, there could be this whole structure of bots that were just promoting, like, pro-Hillary stuff. We don't really
know.
There
is, for sure. And I went through and did, you know, like, this isn't the first work I've done on this topic. So I actually linked to a Google Doc, which has some of my earlier work. Here's the thing. My advantage, honestly, is that I have BrainSpace, and it does both the content and the connectivity graph at the same time. So I can slice by people who care about right-wing shit and who are talking at a certain day or a certain time period, and I can see the connectivity graph, if that makes sense. It's a mistake if you try to just analyze by counting shit. There's so much of that. Or only by, like, counting how many times someone mentions Patriot. Because there's people talking against and for Patriots.
Right. And as you say, they, as the Clemson researchers did, throwing them into arbitrary categories or buckets that you just decided on also colors the data in a way that may be confusing.
It straight up colors it. You colored it. It's like you just drew an arbitrary circle on the graph and you're like, well, here's our grouping. And I'm like, well, I don't know. It's not like how classification works. It's just you making a color.
Right. So how do you do it right, I guess? What, and is there useful intelligence to be gleaned from this stuff?
I'll give you an example, which is the way I analyzed how the Clemson researchers had mislabeled accounts was I was able to train the neural network on what a pro-Trump tweet is versus an anti-Trump tweet, and then automatically go through and have it classify all of the tweets. So I could say, these tweets are pro-Trump, these tweets are anti-Trump, and these are tweets that are anti-Trump from theoretically pro-Trump sources, if that makes sense, because the Clemson researchers had labeled people either pro or anti. So like being able to just use that as a search query to just say, I'm confident that this is a very pro-Trump tweet as just a search, as if I was going into Google to search on stuff, is part of what makes it better. So you're doing like actual, you're using real machine learning. That's not easy to do. And that's the difference, is realistically, it's usability.
Right. You were more favorable of the Duo research than the Clemson research, but Duo's wasn't perfect.
Duo, again, because of like, okay, the answer obviously has to be machine learning and machine classification. It cannot be you personally, or a Clemson researcher personally going through and analyzing the tweets mentally, because it's just too many. That's just ridiculous. That's like insane. It's like me trying to count sand. I'm not going to do it. It's just stupid. So, but I mean, I'm not a social scientist, so for them, the idea of using a like machine learning algorithm is very difficult. Whereas I'd had it like literally, I can clicky-clicky, and I don't have to do any coding. That's the thing. It's like you have to look at the groupings that a machine learning algorithm would put together, and then you try to name those groupings. And they change over time. This is the other thing. It's like I don't think they can notice them changing because they can't. No human brain can take in that kind of information. But the machine can. The machine can say, well, in this time period, they're grouped like this, and in this time period, they're grouped like that. Like there's a whole cloud of SoundCloud stuff that they had to ignore, but there's no reason to ignore it. Like the different languages. Like it's fascinating to see all the different languages that these trolls use to push different things in different places. That's fascinating.
Yeah, Italian, German, Dutch.
And in the Dutch thing, they were on par. Like they clearly have a Dutch linguist. And that Dutch linguist is like, as soon as that shooting happened in Belgium, was pushing anti-Islam stuff in Dutch. Perfect Dutch. Just fascinating. Right. There's so much here. That's the thing. I get so excited.
So there is a there, right? These operations are going on. As you pointed out, they do tend to wait for moments that are favorable to them, such as in the wake of some horrible traumatic event, shooting or natural disaster or what have you, to ramp up their activity and, draft off of that. And then they might die down. You know, you can go sort of mad looking at this stuff too long. So I guess for those of us outside of the intelligence community, what do you think are the big takeaways from this data set? Again, the Internet Research Agency tweet data.
I would say it's a much bigger and broader operation than I think the public is aware of. And I would say that there's a lot more attempts to organize physical activity than I had suspected. There were a lot of rallies that were attempted to be started. They would set up a rally page on Facebook and then get people to join it via Twitter and then like actually try to send people places, right? Like that's fascinating to me.
Yeah.
And I didn't quite collect enough information to find out if any of those had actually worked. Like how many people showed up to the following? I don't know. I don't have their rally where they killed all the Facebook pages too.
Yeah, man, we know Facebook and Twitter are, more on top of this now than they were, a year and a half ago, but is it your expectation that type of activity is still going
on? Now I'd say that here's the thing that I researched before this data set, is some of these bots are indistinguishable from real people unless you look at LinkedIn and like try to actually track the person down and realize the person does not exist. Because they'll have like a whole legend. Like in the spy world, you'd have what they call a legend, which is like your fake persona. But these days, I can verify your fake name and what you say you do. Oh, you're a small business owner in like Tucson, Arizona, named the following thing, black male, X age, I can go look you up. And if you're not there, you know, like, that's fascinating because people are not that covert in real life. So that's the thing, like, without doing a crap ton of legwork of external verification, the modern bots, like the modern people that they throw out there, are not discernible from normal people, but except for their views, you know, like, except for the fact that they're like rabid right-wing, Jesus-loving, you know, patriot-touting, angry black male, right? Like, you're like, well, that's a little weird, but that was more scary to me as I got into it. Like, I'm not a data researcher. I don't know what this is. Like, I have a day job. I run a company, you know, or I used to.
I think the term is data analyst, Dave.
It's work worth doing in a sense, because I think it's a much broader effort than we suspected. I think you already knew, but I don't think the general public knows that.
Yeah. Yeah. What's the response? I mean, I'm reading a lot of articles now that are sort of saying basically the platform is the problem, that, you know, they're not doing enough to police this activity, both the, you know, disinformation campaigns and then just the, you know, racist, anti-Semitic stuff. And that this is really all on Twitter and Facebook.
But see, they would have to do the same thing I did, where they take, like, they make judgments on particular accounts, and you have to take all of the content into context, which is really hard. You know, like, everyone just wants their value system stamped onto every platform.
Sure.
And that's just
right.
Like, oh, I'm offended at what this guy said. Why is he still here? I'm like, knock it off. That's stupid. I don't understand. Like, I think we should align the incentives properly. Like, I don't think bots should be able to click ads, but otherwise it's just a stupid idea to make Twitter the global censor.
I mean, it strikes me that we built in the last, you know, whatever, 15 years, these massive social media platforms that really have sort of replaced, like, broadcast media as how people are connecting and getting information.
But how terrible is broadcast media? Every time someone, like, blames it on Twitter and Facebook, I'm like, have you watched the news?
Yeah,
CNN's
no, I know.
Going on about like aliens. These news programs are terrible. And
yeah,
I've been on the news 1,000 times, and it's the boss every time. That's not information. You get better news from Twitter, even if it's like, oh, it's colored. It's colored the same way the news is. Old people blaming technology.
Right. But I guess from the geopolitical standpoint, from the sort of nation state versus nation state standpoint, though, it strikes me that at least in the United States and maybe some of our allies, that there was a slowness to recognize, I think, how powerful these platforms are, and then obviously how they could be easily manipulated or misused.
We just almost don't have an immune system right now. Right. Like, that's the problem. It's like, we're not reacting. We didn't turn off the Patriot Army. Why not?
Right.
They're still there. And it's not just them. It's like there's a bunch of other propaganda websites that I looked at before, like Off Guardian. And there's like 100 others. They have people literally writing articles full time. Insane articles about how, like, the actual fancy bear hackers are Ukrainian or some crazy shit just all day, every day. Just none of that gets pushed back by the U.S. government. All of these players in government have thrown their credibility into the fire, and I have no idea why. They just thought it was okay. Well, like, every aspect of our government has done some nonsense thing to ruin their credibility.
Right.
And so, of course, we're not pushing back on the Russians.
Okay, so a couple questions. One is, you know, we've got very important midterm elections coming up here in November in the United States. I've been covering this in the podcast from different angles, but we're still looking historically, you know, you and I are talking about stuff that got tweeted, you know, 6 months or a year and a half ago. What do you think we'll see in the coming months as we get closer to that November election day in terms of these campaigns? Do you think we'll see them reemerge?
They did not go away. I still see them, even though Twitter did their full call. This is the thing about the white supremacy groups that I've been watching, right? Like, I followed the head of this Unite the Right group. If you look at his stream, he straight up says, like, I had 4,000 followers removed. That's a third of his followers got killed by Twitter. But I still see very obvious Russian bots in his tweet followers. First of all, I don't think that the cullings are working, but I also don't think these efforts have ever stopped. So I don't see a decrease realistically. You don't see them like, oh, well, we got caught, we better knock this activity off. No, they're going the same level of activity. Their contract hasn't ended. whatever money they're getting paid by the Russians has, like, you know, continued over time. So I would say that this is continuing. It's going to be a factor. I just don't know how big a factor. That's the hard part to measure. That's why I'm trying to apply some advanced machine learning to the problem so I can figure out if it's working, because that's what I really want to know. It's not just like, oh, they're sending a bunch of tweets and whatever. No, I want to know, what are the real people adopting out of this information stream that they're trying to push out? That's what I want to apply real science to.
What is the story here for the media? I mean, in some ways, the bots and the disinformation over social media, Twitter and Facebook and so on, it's no longer even a story. It's just something that is happening. And it seems, as you said, to more or less be a constant. Is the story, how is this influencing actual people? Who is getting drawn into these?
I think so. I think that's the story. Like, but it's a really hard story.
Who's in the Patriot Army and what are they doing?
Exactly, because they might actually be doing something with those people, right? Like, can you find any actual Marines in the U.S. Patriot Army who signed up for that thing? Because those people are going to get targeted for human intelligence, or worse.
Dave, did you sign up for the Patriot Army?
I did not. I did not sign up for the Patriot Army. But, I mean, that was just one of the many things that they were doing. And because this ties into a human intelligence effort, it ties into a lot of other things other than just pushing ideas. But I mean, if you look at a lot of it, I try to measure, because I have this ability to like turn off who's in and who's out. So I try to measure who's the recipient of most of the messages. And like, obviously real Donald Trump's account is a huge glowing nuclear fire in the middle of any Twitter diagram you draw. Like, I can slice any set of data with any keyword, and I still have to normalize for real Donald Trump. He's the freaking sun. He's a supernova glowing down upon Twitter right now.
On this part of Twitter,
not just this part. I did NBC News's followers. Every slice of Twitter is real Donald Trump right now. And a lot of it is people tweeting at real Donald Trump things to encourage, to keep it so it seems like the vast majority of people are behind certain ideas. Which is like, because they're influence ops. That's what you do. You go to the leader. So like, they'll target Sean Hannity. They'll target real Donald Trump. They'll target various news organizations or anyone they see that has an influence. Yeah. And they'll try to influence. It's amazing to see. When you see stuff, you see them targeting, like there's a lot of bots pushing political messages in Hindi. I don't read Hindi, so I don't know what exactly they're pushing. You see a lot of the U.S. politics spilling into the New Zealand sphere, but you don't see like the same patterns as I would see here on almost like CNN or NBC or any of the like populations that I've studied.
And as we started talking about, I mean, obviously there is a spillover into the real world. You know, you look at companies like Kaspersky Lab, you know, there are any number of other companies, entities who are going to get blowback from this in one way or another. I mean, what is the proper way to respond to this from the U.S. government standpoint? I mean, I guess sanctioning or throwing Kaspersky out to the, you know, kicking them to the curb will accomplish a little bit, but probably not that much.
I think it would accomplish a lot more if we said explicitly what we were sanctioning Kaspersky for, in a way. Like, and Kaspersky's made this point, right? He's like, what the hell are you guys doing? You can't just do this without actually naming me in some way as having done something specifically wrong.
Name my sin,
We're like, you know what you did. It's kind of, it's weird to me. It's all like weird parenting.
Like, yes.
You go home to your teenager and you're like, you're grounded and you know why, and you don't say anything more.
It's like when my sister-in-law carved "I love you, Daddy" into, you know, my father-in-law's desk, but then signed my wife's name to it.
You know, that's as clear a description of current cyber politics as any you can get. Just really the sad thing.
I love you, Daddy, at Real Donald.
Right, that's really what it is.
Hey, thank you so much for talking to me on a Sunday evening, and good work once
again. Anytime. Thank you so much.
Up next, when the firm Cyber Reason set up a honeypot network designed to look just like a functioning industrial control system environment, they were expecting to attract a few flies. What they weren't expecting was to attract a swarm of online attackers, including one who managed to both compromise their network and then offer it up for sale on a cyber criminal bulletin board. But Ross Rostici, Cyber Reason's Senior Director of Intelligence Services, says that we shouldn't be surprised that rank-and-file cyber criminals have taken an interest in critical infrastructure systems. Rostici says that while these attackers aren't as stealthy or sophisticated as nation-state actors, they're hardly
script kiddies either. Their interest in critical infrastructure systems may be a worrying sign, Rustici said, suggesting that profit-motivated attackers and attacks may be in the cards for critical infrastructure owners and operators.
Ross Rustici, I'm the Senior Director for Intelligence Services at Cyberism.
So we kind of have two distinct chapters to the story. We spun up a full Honey network. It's not just one system that looks like industrial control system, but it's rather something that mimics a power substation with an IT network and an operational technology network. It's all intertwined. And so we opened up a couple servers that were public facing with public IPs with weak credentials for RDP to see who comes knocking on the door. We know there are a lot of people who scan for RDP and try to brute force it. So we figured we'd get some activity. We weren't expecting to see as much activity as we did as early as we did. Within 2 days of going live, we had somebody who most likely resold this access on Extedia come in, break through the weak RDP password, drop a tool that specifically allows multiple RDP sessions to be ongoing at the same time, created a couple additional user accounts, and then went quiet. Within 5 days of that initial activity, we saw one of those user accounts pop up and start being very active in the environment. And the reason why we don't really think it's necessarily APT type activity is because when they first dropped onto the box, they made a lot of noise. They tried to uninstall all of our security software that we had on that particular box. And they did it within like 5 minutes of logging on. We then restarted that machine, reloaded the security software, hardened it, not completely hardened. So there was still a couple avenues for them to manipulate it to see how determined they were going to be in trying to remove the security software. Within about 15 minutes of bringing all the security software back online, they disabled it all again. So they're very determined to not be observed in whatever they were doing. But by doing that, they drew a lot of attention to themselves.
Presumably a state-sponsored actor would have been quieter.
Right, and most of the nation-state actors have a couple tricks up their sleeve to essentially neuter security software so it doesn't beacon back with the information. They don't usually go and uninstall it wholesale because when a probe drops offline from any monitored environment, that immediately causes a red flag. It's far better to try to hide in the noise of what's going on or manipulate the way the probe is sending data back rather than get rid of it entirely. I mean, so that was the first really big red flag when I was looking at the data to say, this guy is in the upper tier, upper echelon of cyber act. Pretty good because what he does after this is all living off the land, all use of PowerShell, all use of tools that are inherent in the network to laterally move. Based off of the activity that we're seeing, I would put them at kind of mid to upper tier cybercrime. They've been operating for a while. They know how to operate in the environment, and they know exactly what they're going after. They don't seem to be upper echelon, and they're certainly above the script kiddie who's doing point-and-click Metasploit, that type of stuff. So they started moving through the environment very precisely, looking for access to the industrial control systems themselves. We set up the network in an approximation of the way a live environment would be, so most of the operational technology is firewalled off from the IT side of the network. There are a couple places where there's some overlap in the network that if you get there, you could probably swim upstream to the industrial control systems, but they're hard to get to. And we see on every box that this actor migrates to, they drop a persistence mechanism, and then they immediately start scanning, trying to get into that operational infrastructure. They so far haven't succeeded in compromising the right box to be able to jump onto the industrial control systems. But that's one of the reasons why we're leaving the environment live, because we want to see what happens when they finally do get access to it. I mean, I think that'll be the most telling from our perspective in terms of what level of sophistication we're dealing with. Because it's not that hard to scan for these types of boxes in a network. It's not that hard to try to go directly for them if you have a decent understanding of the way networks work and a decent understanding of how these systems can be set up. Where you really start seeing the difference between the elite hackers who really know what they're doing and somebody who's just playing around trying to prove technical capability or just interest in this type of network because they haven't been able to access it before is how carefully they operate on the industrial control systems themselves and whether they take care not to trigger some real-world effect through a missed keystroke. We've seen a lot of nation-state actors make mistakes when it comes to hacking industrial control systems. The amateur guys, the cyber criminal guys, have less access and less training to be able to operate successfully on those types of systems, and they're going to be more prone to mistakes that have real-world effects.
And that's really what we're looking to see, whether once they get on the system, do they know what they're doing, or are they feeling around and groping in the dark?
So from what you've seen so far, it's you haven't necessarily made up your mind about what type of actor this is.
No, I would lean towards not nation state right now based off of what we've seen, but there's enough trappings of somebody who's motivated and capable and has a solid playbook for this environment where I'm not ready to rule that out either.
You know, obviously we hear a lot about intrusions or targeting of critical infrastructure such as power generation and distribution networks. It's surprising to me, well, I mean, I know that this is a honeypot and so it's not an actual network, but that, you know, RDP, remote desktop protocol, which is used to kind of remotely access servers, maintain them, service them, and so on, is that actually a pretty common avenue of attack on these networks and pretty commonly used? You'd think that there would be a lot of awareness, sensitivity, and security around that type of capability.
So RDP is in many ways the easy button for hacking. And unfortunately, there are a lot of networks that still allow RDP, whether it's from misconfiguration of firewalls or for legitimate management. Industrial control systems, power generation, when you're getting into the critical infrastructure, key resources as defined by DHS, there's an alarming amount of open ports and open utilities that probably should be locked down. Part of it comes from a lot of remote administration of hard to reach sites physically. And part of it comes from the fact that a lot of these systems are legacy and we're cobbled together over several generations of technology. So people aren't fully aware of what they're actually operating. As kind of a side tangent, one of the incident response that I went on a while ago, a hacker got into an industrial control system because there was a dial-up modem as part of the gear that the IT manager had no idea was there. The only reason why we stumbled upon it was because somebody happened to dial into it while we were walking through the facility and we heard that telltale screeching sound. And so, yes, in an ideal world, we'd like to see all of these holes patched. We'd like to see it all monitored very well. In reality, all of these networks are so oddly configured and have so much technology in it that there's always going to be a couple holes in them. And it might not be RDP, it might be SSH, it might be some other hole that's there, but odds are there is at least one. I haven't seen a network that is unhackable yet from a misconfiguration standpoint.
I mean, the other implication of what you're saying is that in addition to nation state actors who might be looking to gain, you know, persistence on these networks, there are also ordinary cyber criminals who are targeting these networks merely to resell them or potentially to just use them in the types of activities, criminal activities, you know, botnets and crypto mining and so on that they use other systems for.
You definitely see the run-of-the-mill crypto mining, botnet spamming on the IT side of things. And because we had weakened RDP, we saw a lot of that kind of junk intrusion activity in the honeypot as well. We just shut it down and kind of ignored it because it's the run-of-the-mill stuff. The thing that I think was most alarming to us was the sale of the access for this particular organization and the fact that the hacker who came in was very much focused on the industrial control aspect itself. The fact that there are people who have the potential not to be nation state actors going after industrial control systems greatly increases the risk that those systems are facing because they're going to be less skilled in operating on them. And the obvious monetization aspects are less. To me, as a defender kind of trying to think through the motivation of an attacker, gaining access to an industrial control system, it's not that great for crypto mining because it doesn't have the same high-level CPU that most desktop computers have. Mm-hmm. It isn't really that useful as a jumping off point because it's buried inside networks. Really, the mm-hmm. only thing that I can see as a monetization aspect is holding it for ransom. And once you get into that aspect of things, if that's where cyber criminal groups are going towards, we're in a much worse situation than we were when it was just nation states doing it for deterrence purposes and signaling.
It's always possible, of course, that a nation state looking to gain access to one of these networks might peruse a cyber marketplace and see if somebody's already done their dirty work for them as well, right?
Yes, and that's one of the reasons why we're not ready to walk out that limb of attribution and make a call one way or the other, especially yep. because we know the Russians use a lot of dual-hatted hackers. They both mm-hmm. do cybercrime and they also do jobs for the Russian state. So it's entirely possible that this is one of those actors that does a little freelance for the Russian state, jumped on an opportunity and is looking to essentially upsell himself in whatever apparatus that he's in.
Is it too much to say, or drawing too big a conclusion to say, that there may be a ransomware risk to some of these critical infrastructure environments that previously, you know, we haven't tended to think of those as ransomware targets?
So I know that there are a handful of examples over the last 7 years or so of critical infrastructure being ransomed by cybercrime groups. Most of it's taken place in Latin America and Eastern Europe. We can't say in this particular case whether that's their end goal. But right now, I'd say that there is definitely a risk there. I think it's one that we don't tend to think about as security professionals because there aren't as many headline-grabbing instances of it as, say, municipalities getting hit by run-of-the-mill ransomware variants. But anytime you have a critical system that is vulnerable to a hacker and there is a large cost associated with losing access to it, there is always a ransom component for motivating cyber criminals.
What's the advice then for critical infrastructure owners to be attentive to and on the lookout for these types of threats and attacks?
Always harden your system. I will always start with the boilerplate. Patch, update, monitor well. Don't make it easy for them. But the big takeaway for us is have proper segmentation. The fact that we did a moderately good job of doing segmentation between these two fake networks has really slowed down the hacker's ability to get to their end goal. If you do the segmentation properly, put up the right interior firewalls, do defense in depth, and ability to monitor both the operational infrastructure and the IT environment in a unified way, you're going to see the picture a lot clearer, a lot faster, and you're going to be able to respond in a much shorter time frame, and that's really how you prevent an intrusion from becoming a real breach in instance. So a lot of it is in security best practices that are already there, but pay very close attention to that east-west traffic in your network between the two segments.
Ross Ustishi of Cyber Reason, thanks so much for coming on and speaking to us on the Security Ledger podcast. It was great having you.
Thank you for having me.